It was a week here in Michigan.
The next governor of the state of Michigan, Tudor Nixon.
Michigan, Whitmer doesn't get it. The truth is, she doesn't care.
We'll have a robust debate. It'll probably look similar no matter who comes out of that primary because they are all very similar. I'm going to stay focused on the issues.
Democrats are delivering. We are delivering for this country, unity through delivery.
Hundreds of thousands of Michiganders voted on hundreds of political candidates across the state, including on the Republican who will now run against incumbent Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer in November. For the first time in generations and generations, there will not be a Black representative of Congress from Detroit. And we had courts make what felt like was decision after head-spinning decision all in one day about the legality of abortion in Michigan. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in today for April Bear. We are going to dig into all of these stories and much, much more on a Stateside special today, wrapping up the week's political news in Michigan. Joining us as well is Emily Lawler, state government and politics editor at the Detroit Free Press. Emily, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. And we've got Greg Bowens, founder of Bowens & Co. He has worked in Democratic politics for decades. Greg, welcome.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. And the one and only John Truscott, CEO of the Lansing public relations firm Truscott Rossman. John, hello.
Hi, Zoe. Great to be here.
So good to have you. And John, I actually want to start with you. So Tudor Dixon won Tuesday's Republican primary for governor. Dixon's a former conservative media personality, really little name recognition or money raised, right, until she got two super high profile endorsements back in May. That was from the DeVos family and from Right to Life. Now, a week ago, last Friday night, she got former President Donald Trump's endorsement. Were those all the reasons why she won on Tuesday?
You know, I think we saw, if you look at the polls that are out there and the money, the fundraising that she was able to do, the trajectory that she was on after the DeVos announcement and then Right to Life comes through, she was definitely just jumping out to the lead at that point. The Trump endorsement, I view, just kind of sealed the deal, but it was after the fact and after she had really generated a really, really strong lead. So, I think it helped that two of the candidates had petition problems, so you didn't split as many of the votes. And it really allowed her to kind of come up through the middle as the least extreme of all the candidates.
Greg, talk to me. Have you ever seen anything like this in Michigan primary politics before? Five completely unknown candidates basically coming to the ballot with so little name recognition. And up till even last week, I believe undecided was still getting the plurality of votes.
Oh, yeah. I think that, we've seen, you know, a big surprise. But the big hit-making thing here is that you have two women facing off in a November election for the top job in the state. I don't think that's something that we have seen before. And to be honest with you, Tudor Dixon's entry into the Republican primary from our perspective, looking at it here as a Democrat, was we always suspected that she was probably going to be the one to get the nod just on the gender thing. The idea that having someone who could at least present a picture, an equal sort of picture with Governor Whitmer, was going to be something that was going to happen. And, you know, the craziness that has gone on. I feel sometimes for you, John, and the kind of things that you guys have had to endure with this latest iteration of the Tea Party madness. I call this Tea Party, you know, on 10 when it comes to the MAGA crowd and the things that they have done and the election deniers and all that stuff. It almost makes you long for the days of the Bush Republicans and things of that nature. And so, you know, seeing Tudor Dixon, she seemed like the obvious choice. And I think that it's fair to say that most people saw it that way too. They weren't really paying attention to the issues because those folks, you know, just weren't really that far apart on the issues. It was who can beat Governor Whitmer, who has a chance of beating her. I don't think anybody has a chance, but who has the best chance? And certainly having another woman share the stage with her, you know, makes things more challenging just from a visual perspective, if nothing else.
Well, and I want to dig in a little while to what that's actually going to look like, that Dixon versus Whitmer race. But I got to ask the same question to Emily Lawler, who has been a Capitol reporter before being an editor for years and years, covered many a gubernatorial campaign in Michigan. Have you seen anything like this?
You know, I think this race was pretty unique just in the battle of the unknowns aspect. You know, I think that a lot of people, when the primary field was shaping up, when people were getting in, I mean, I was among those calling known quantities and saying, are you running? Is anyone you know running? And the bottom line is, you know, the five people who ended up on the ballot, I would not have known their names, you know, a year and a half or 2 years ago. So I do think that there was a battle just sort of for name recognition. You know, if I don't know their names, I'm pretty politically plugged in. And I think it was sort of a testament to how much of a newcomer, literally everyone on that Republican ballot was. None of them had ever held elected office. And we're talking like not on the local school board, right? So I do think that that it's sort of unique just in the level of inexperience that the whole field brought. But, you know, to their credit, I think that they make a case that there's an asset, that they can come in with sort of some fresh perspective and that they can shake things up. I think the whole field did a pretty good job arguing that. I would take a little bit of an issue with John. You said earlier that Dixon sort of zipped up that more moderate middle lane. You know, she was sort of on I guess sort of in that lane, but I think certainly you'd say Kevin Rinke was far more moderate and spent far more money. So I do think that you know, her lane was a little bit different, and I think she had.
Yeah, he just never caught fire was the problem,
yeah.
His issues and what he ran on. And she did and kind of took over that space from him in the last weeks.
Yeah, certainly. But, you know, things like, you know, Tudor Dixon is on record saying she thinks Trump really won the 2020 election here in Michigan. You know, she opposes abortion in all instances except to save the life of the mother, including rape and incest. Those are, you know, positions that are certainly to the right of the ones that Kevin Rinke took in this primary.
Well, and John.
Yeah, Rinke needed you, John. Rinke needed you bad, man. I mean, you know.
I don't do partisan campaigns anymore. I'm out of that craziness.
And he's happy
right?
For
well,
it.
I enjoy life too much.
Oh, no, I feel you. I feel you. But you folks got to remember that Rick Snyder was an unknown when he jumped into the race to be governor. You know, everybody had a gateway computer, but nobody knew who ran the company. And so, you know, Rick Snyder jumped up and jumped in there. And that was a big unknown. So the unknown factor doesn't really I don't think that's the history making part here. When you look at history in these primaries.
Well, but
particularly when you have a strong governor that, you know, nobody, you know, the establishment doesn't feel like anybody can beat.
But
you know,
does that
so it's
get,
like, who are we going to sacrifice?
Right. But does that get back
who's
to
who's going
to
do it? We did it with the Lansing mayor. Remember that, John? That guy?
I sure do. I will just say, I remember a race in 1990 where there was a very popular incumbent and kind of a relatively unknown challenger that nobody thought could win.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are some similarities to talk about.
Oh, that's true. Are you talking about John Engler? That's true.
I am.
I was going to say one
that's
John
true.
Engler
came out of nowhere.
Who John Truscott worked for many years, who I should say the former governor John Engler was at this unity lunch on Wednesday. This was the day after the primary. Tudor Dixon had won. John, the former governor Engler, introduced Dixon as Michigan's next governor, as, you know, of course, one does in these kind of political machinations,
sure.
Right? But your former boss, John Engler, had previously endorsed James Craig, who, as we remember, got booted off the ballot back in May for not having enough valid signatures. Can you break us down in the next little few minutes that we have here? What does that endorsement process look like? Like, is the Dixon campaign calling the former governor going, okay, you know, James Craig isn't in anymore, look at us? Like, how does that all work?
you know, they did have people calling around and talking to folks and people reaching out even after he had endorsed James Craig. They kept in touch. They were very savvy and shrewd about keeping people that even weren't supporting her, keeping them close. So should things change, they would come over. And, you know, after the Craig campaign really just failed to do some of the basics that Greg, you and I have been doing for decades. We know how to do this and how to scrub the lists and make sure that the names are valid. I can only just say that he hired the wrong people. And it was an embarrassment. And Perry Johnson, the same thing. So, you know, the whole dynamic of the race changed when they got kicked off the ballot, and it exposed for everybody that they just didn't have what it takes to run a statewide campaign.
Oh, I mean, you know, John, James Craig launching his campaign on Belle Isle, you know, I mean, he had to know that Detroit was going to breathe all over him. When the Detroit Will Breathe people showed up and the Black Lives Matter people showed up,
yeah,
you know, and ran him off the island. I mean, this whole thing started as a fiasco, and it was not checking the signatures. I don't believe that guy went out and got one signature, you know, and neither did Perry. And
well, Greg,
you know,
I'll also say any Republican whose strategy is to get their votes from Detroit, Flint, Benton Harbor, Muskegon probably isn't going to win.
Okay, you all. So we have spent some time talking about Tudor Dixon, the Republican nominee for governor. Let's not forget the Democrat. Let's turn to Governor Gretchen Whitmer. She was also on the ballot on Tuesday, though, of course, she was running unopposed. John, from your seat in Lansing, what are her chances?
Her chances are pretty good. It's not a guarantee. I think any party that thinks that an election is a lock is destined to have some surprises. But I think anybody would handicap the race right now in her favor. I think I've met Tudor Dixon. I think she's really sharp. She's very bright. She's a quick study. I'm really impressed with her. So I think she will make this a very tough race. It's a narrow path, but there is a path for her. But she will be fighting from back as the underdog the entire time.
Greg, the
John's right. I mean,
go ahead, Emily.
Oh, John's right that I think Tudor Dixon can make this a real contest. Greg mentioned earlier that there's this interesting woman on woman dynamic. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I think that's something unique that Michiganders haven't really seen before, unless someone with more history wants to correct me. But in any case, you know, both of them have really emphasized sort of a family's first message. Both of them have expressed some sort of desire to focus on dinner table issues. And we'll see. Frankly, you know, I think that Democrats would benefit if the race was focused on issues like abortion and maybe some of the things that they've been able to deliver, largely through a giant influx in pandemic spending, federal pandemic spending. But also, you know, Republicans have a really strong case to make on sort of the economic side of that dinner table conversation right now. We'll see what gas prices are like in a couple months. Mm-hmm. We'll see what inflation is like in a couple months. But I think Republicans are trying to, you know, pin that message of that they could do better economically and that the economy is not in the best place it could be in right now.
Greg, I want us
all
to...
Yeah, you know, Emily, you make some...
Greg, just a second. Okay. I want us all to just listen to this clip of Tudor Dixon in her speech on Tuesday night. And then, Greg, I particularly want from the Democratic perspective your thoughts about what, again, Republican Tudor Dixon said Tuesday night.
The battle lines in this race couldn't be any clearer. This is going to be an epic battle between a conservative businesswoman and mother and a far-left birthing parent and career politician.
Oof. Greg, is that going to be the sort of Dixon strategy? And then how does what does Whitmer do to counter what really is this sort of far right strategy here?
As a listener, okay, you know what? What she just said is all hyperbole. And sometimes when you get caught up, particularly if you're a first time candidate and you go through a primary, you know, you're not really used to understanding that the primary is over and you have to appeal to a general, you know, the general population out there. That stuff that she just said, that was all right wing crazy nut stuff that we have been hearing, and is the kind of thing that's almost juvenile in the way that it is put out there, calling her names, you know, all this stuff. It's like I'm listening to an eighth grader talk here and try and communicate when, you know, they're not really finding the words to grab the bigger picture and the issues that people are really faced with. And that, I think that's unfortunately, that's part of the challenge or leftover from the Trump era. You know, Trump insulted his way through the primary and joked his way to the presidency in lots of ways by practicing the politics of grief, where cruelty is the point. And what she just said right there on that clip from Tuesday is part of appealing to that cruelty is the point thing. And this is the kind of thing that makes me miss regular Republicans that I could disagree with big time on policy issues and stuff like that. But we could have that argument. We could have the discussion on policy. But you can't have a discussion about policy when you're listening to someone talk like that and insult people like that. So she's got a long way to go in relationship to being able to appeal to the regular voter. The other thing is that's really important about this, and Emily, you know, started to parse it out a bit and talking about economics, but there are some things that are floating around out here that are going to shape this race far more than anything that Tudor Dixon can say. And the big one we haven't even talked about yet is abortion and the issue of abortion. That overturning Roe versus Wade and the stance that the Republican Party has taken in relationship to being against abortion has thrown kerosene on a gas fire. It really has. And people want to be able to express their voice in this. I mean, 1973, the right for a woman to be able to have an abortion in a safe manner supported by the healthcare system is something that has been going on since 1973. And before that, people still had abortions. It was just not safe. It was not safe. And so, you know, this is not the 60s, man. And I think that, you know, even in the discussion of abortion, which I think is going to supercharge these politics and put Tudor Dixon in a corner that she's not going to be able to get out of. One of the constituencies that we don't talk about, but that is eventually going to start to come forward, are men. Now, men don't get much to say, you know, in this, but they do get a vote. And the idea that men who have grown up under a system, understanding that abortion is a choice for their wives, daughters, girlfriends, you know, and things of that nature. I 9 out of 10 guys that I know want to keep abortion safe and legal, seriously. And that's going to be that sort of a silent voice that's out there, but it is an important voice, and I think it's going to be heard. So abortion is going to be, it's on the ballot. And their positions can't be any more different on there. Certainly the economy, and let's not forget COVID, and now we got monkeypox running around out here. And so all these things can impact it. And I'll tell you what, the Tudor Dixons of the world who are talking about COVID as if, you know, nothing ever really happened, only a couple of people died, and it was worse because of the policies that came out from the Biden administration and Governor Whitmer. That argument, like the big lie, is really not going to fly. We have lost way too many people to be second guessing, you know, the impact of COVID. And that's gonna, I think that those discussions are gonna be in play too. And it's just, it's really interesting. It's a shame that she came out the box talking like that. But I'm happy about it because it really shows, you know, the eighth grade, you know, sort of language that's being tossed about here that people are just going to tune out. She's just not as entertaining as Trump was on that front. And the politics of grievance and the politics of where cruelty is actually the point, I don't really think is going to fly with a general election audience.
John, if you were advising Tudor Dixon, what would you tell her message should be leading into November?
Well, there are a couple things, and I agree with Greg on a few things, and I strongly disagree. One, the whole COVID nursing home issue is real. Tudor Dixon was not able to be with her grandmother when she was dying in the nursing home. State policy locked her out. That is a really heart-wrenching story that people will hear a lot more about. Now, overall, we were headed into a race before the Supreme Court decision on Dobbs, where you had all of these issues. So one, the Democrats were behind in terms of like the cultural issues that are being espoused by members of the squad, for example, defund the police and a lot of the crazy rhetoric that they have. That was running in Republicans' favor. When the Dobbs decision came, it distracts completely from that. Also distracts from the dissatisfaction with the president. His numbers are horrible with Republicans, independents, and Democrats. That was giving Republicans a strong advantage, and I think that's probably wiped away now. It's very difficult to overcome the single issue that a lot of people make their mind up on. So, you know, I think Tudor Dixon's comments about the cultural issues are relevant. I think there are a lot of people who respond to them, and they're real. And people just don't talk about it publicly because they know they'll be criticized for talking about it. So that's a component. But I do believe when Republicans were looking at a red wave, the Dobbs decision changes that entire equation.
Emily, from your perspective, talk to me a little bit about Gretchen Whitmer. She has raised a historic amount of money, right? In sort of this time as governor, a total of nearly $30 million. What does that mean for her campaign and her ability then to get out the Democratic messaging that we've been talking about over the last few minutes?
I mean, this is just silly money when you look at gubernatorial campaigns. I mean, frankly, I think it's more money than you could even deploy effectively on a single race. I think that obviously some of it will go into other Democratic issues. She's been raising a lot nationally. My colleague Paul Egan looked in recently to where all this money was coming from, and she's been flying out and having fundraisers in other states, and I think that's really boosted the bottom line, and it's made her an investment race for Democrats nationally, right? So Gretchen Whitmer, make no mistake, is a pretty big get for Democrats right now generally, and they're going to do what they can to make sure that she doesn't lose that seat. Conversely, that puts a pretty big target on her back for Republicans. Certainly, I would not be surprised to see a lot of national money coming in for Tudor Dixon, specifically, through PACs and other vehicles, probably. But that war chest is just formidable, no matter how you look at it.
Emily, you hit on something that I don't think anybody's really talking about yet, but they will be. I predict that Gretchen Whitmer will be on the national ticket in 2 years. This is the way this is shaping up with her profile, the number of interviews, and the amount of money she's raising. She becomes a prime candidate for the Democratic Party.
Yeah. No, that's not true. I mean, certainly people would like for that to be true, but I don't think that's true. They were saying that this last go around that she was on the short list and, you know, she might run and that kind of thing. And, you know, we have not seen a governor from Michigan, well, in a long, long, long time, you know, make it on that track. We have seen them become part of an administration at some point. But, you know, I don't see that right now. I mean, right now on the presidential thing, we still got the tale of two grandpas. And which one do you want to be with? You want to be with the mean one or you want to be with the nice one? And when you put Trump and President Biden in head-to-head polls, Biden still comes out ahead, even with all this stuff that's going on. So I appreciate what you're saying, John, but I don't think it's going to pan out like that.
Greg, I miss you. I'm willing to wager dinner.
You are always trying to bet for years.
I don't bet.
That is,
I would be a bystander at dinner.
Emily, you're invited. Absolutely.
I was going to say, wait, can't the four of us be this? We are talking.
We could do the show from dinner. That would be.
Yeah, no, you brought us together. We will do the dinner.
Right, dinner and a show. Emily, what?
Well, you know. I was just going to add on that point with the governor's race before we leave it. You know, normally, you know, the parties put all of their money at the top of the ticket to make it happen, particularly in a competitive race. But this season has been so wild And, you know, the language that's been coming out, you know, trying to shape this race with, you know, we heard the eighth grade insulting speech from Tudor Dixon a little while ago. If it's going to be more than that, then I think, you know, the National Party, the GOP, and John, these are your people, even though you're not in partisan politics anymore. The fight is going to be for the congressional delegation and for the state legislature, you know, with redistricting and how all that is going to play out. And I think you're going to see more money spent, you know, there in trying to shore up, certainly from our perspective as Democrats, trying to get the state legislature, something we mm-hmm. haven't had in decades, mm-hmm. and maybe even having the opportunity to flip some of these congressional seats here in Michigan. When you got some crazy, crazy people like Gibbs running around out there who beat Meyer, who I actually like. I don't agree with his politics and all that much, but, you know, so when you have those kind of things happening, it becomes a bigger fight mm-hmm. than just, you know, the matchup, you know, the woman to woman matchup yeah. that everybody's sort of like looking at. There's some real games that can happen here.
I think the bigger problem for Republicans is the mid part of the statewide ticket for AG and Secretary of State. Republicans just did not nominate credible people, and people will cross back over. And then it remains to see, do they yeah. come back to the Republican side or stay on the Dem side? And that's a real risk for Republicans.
Well, and don't you worry that after the Republican nominating convention later in August, we will then be able to do an entire hour, right, once those candidates are set and what that is going to mean for November. Before we take a break, I want to play some audio. Earlier this week, actually on Stateside, we spoke with Rich Shuba. He is a pollster. He is just smart and amazing. And here is what he said about Tudor Dixon and what she needs to do just over the next couple of weeks.
Tudor Dixon has about 35 days. And by that, I mean she has just over a month to unify the Republican Party, to get through a convention and pick a lieutenant governor candidate, to raise a lot of money. More importantly, show that the race can be, I'd say, a mid-single digit competitive race.
Okay, so John, we've got about a minute before we need to take a break. Is all of that what needs to happen in the next, 30 days?
I agree. We're only, 40, 45 days from absentee ballots being mailed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really quick turnaround. People are going to start voting. And look, the Democrats are already on the air with $4 million supporting Governor Whitmer. And I think there's a lot more where that came from.
And Emily, what are you going to be watching for in about 30 seconds left over the next, let's say, month? What, you know, from your editorial vision, what are you going to keep track of in terms of this race that we should all be watching too?
Certainly who she picks for her lieutenant governor candidate is going to be huge. Someone with some political experience, someone with some good geography, perhaps in the suburbs, could really boost that ticket in a way that would be really helpful for her.
Okay. And then also, I will just quickly add.
No, I wouldn't count on it. I wouldn't count on it.
And I'll just really quickly
add. I wouldn't count on that.
whether or not we see a visit by one Donald Trump to the state of Michigan, right? Okay, we're going to take a break here. When we get back, we're going to look at the downfall of Republican Congressman Peter Meyer and what it portends for GOP politics in Michigan.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Support for the Stateside podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
Okay, so let's turn to a race that made national headlines. John Gibbs defeated Peter Meyer in the Republican primary for the new 3rd Congressional District in West Michigan. Gibbs is the trunk backed candidate. He ran against incumbent Peter Meyer. Meyer voted to impeach President Trump in just his first few days as a congressman back in early 2021. Here's John Gibbs on his win Tuesday night.
It sends a message that we have to respect the will of the people. He had all the money in the world, the establishment backing and whatnot, but the people stood up and spoke. The people said that they would not be bought. This is an important lesson for the powers that be out there to learn that they've really got to respect what the people want.
John, why is this race making such national news and is so meaningful? Is it just simply because it's sort of this so-called proxy battle for the Trump versus establishment narrative that's going on in GOP politics right now?
It's a new district, new partisan makeup, and it could flip in the Democrats' favor. It's much more moderate than it was. It had been a traditionally favored Republicans by several points. I think Joe Biden won this seat, this area by about 16 or 18 points, won it handily. So there's a big problem there for Gibbs. Hillary Scolton has run before. She's got name ID. And this is a marginally Democrat district now. So having an ultra-conservative candidate may not play well, and this could flip in the Democrats' favor. On the other hand, the race between Tom Barrett and Alyssa Slotkin is also going to be tight. That one favors Republicans a little bit, so could be a swap, could be a trade, but this is going to be one of those seats that the nation is watching for control of the Congress.
And this got so much attention because it also fits into this kind of strange pattern from the DCCC, where they actually spent money in this district that a lot of people would say promoted Gibbs, touting his conservative credentials. And a lot of people, including a lot of Democrats, aren't very happy about that decision. So I do think that it fits into that national picture as well, which is perhaps why it's gotten an outsized amount of national attention.
The one thing to look at, I don't think anybody's figured this out, but Greg Van Workum from the State House is in that district, and he won just running away with it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know the dynamic that put Gibbs in and Van Workum in. It just doesn't make sense to me, and we'll play that out in the weeks ahead.
Look, as a Democrat, an active Democrat, that was brilliant. Are you kidding me? You know, to Pete Meyer, he is somebody that appeals to Democrats in some ways. I mean, certainly his vote for impeachment won him support among people, you know, some sympathy, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, with him out the race, that's gone. You've got, you know, Mr. Election Denier, a brother, no less, in his place. And, you know, who screams these conspiracy theories and talks all this stuff. And the irony, just the sheer gall of that guy being able to say the will of the people have spoken. The people have spoken when he supported January 6th, when he supported the nonsense that occurred to try and overthrow our government, to be able to stand here and say with a straight face somehow that, you know, the will of the people and respecting almost like I respect democracy, when that was the same guy who said, when he was asked, will you accept the vote? And he said, we'll see. The same kind of like Trump thing. So, you know, the hypocrisy is out there. It'll certainly, you know, show in this race. And it was brilliant to do ads in getting people, the Republicans, to support him. You know, it's going to play out way differently in a general election, and we all know it. And Meyer's way stronger than that guy could have ever been in a general election.
Well, we should note that after Gibbs' win on Tuesday, the seat was moved from toss-up to leans Democrat by the Cook Political Report. Greg, I want to stick with you, and I want to talk about another congressional race in Michigan across the state from the 3rd, the new 13th congressional district, which includes Detroit. There were nine candidates running on Tuesday. State Representative Sri Tanadar won. He previously had run for governor in 2018. Governor Whitmer beat him handedly those 4 years ago. Greg, it's an almost certainty, right, that he will win the general in November, which means for the first time in generations that the city of Detroit will not have a Black representative.
Yeah, I live in the 13th and, you know, paid attention to that. I had a candidate in there who had dropped out of the race early on, Ralph Godbey, because the split. He could have got, you know, felt like he could have won, but felt like, you know, too, there were too many people and needed to drop out because he wanted to look at the bigger picture. And the bigger picture was representation matters. And this is nothing to say. I mean, I like every Democrat who was in that race. I feel like that they all had an opportunity, even, you know, folks at the same time, you know, there were plenty of people that had no business being in that race. They knew. And if you are committed to the idea of representation, you know, being Black is not everything, but it's a big check mark, you know, to represent a majority of a district that has so many, you know, Black folks in it, the blackest city in the country and the blackest region in the country. You know, I'm telling you, man, I get calls and texts from people all over the country saying, what happened? Everybody knows what happened. There were too many people in the race and they split the vote. And Sri is a known candidate. He's a very kind person. He really, really is. And very unassuming. I mean, you know, he could walk down the street and you wouldn't even know who he was. Most people who are millionaires, you can't even get close to him. And he's different from that perspective and has endeared himself in some ways, in many ways, to his neighbors. He moved to Detroit, you know, Sherwood Forest, Palmer Woods, you know, it's nice, but it's a neighborhood. It's in Detroit and it's, you know, 7 miles in Woodward between Woodward and Livernois. I mean, you know, that's Detroit, man. And yet we have this situation where we're struggling with the idea of representation and how much does representation need to matter.
Yep.
And given the history that we've had struggling as African Americans to try and, you know, make a place in this world, the thought that Michigan, you know, really one of the most liberal states in the country, the first state that that outlawed capital punishment, mm-hmm. the state that outlawed slavery, the state that fought for the North, you know, will not have an African-American in a congressional delegation seems like a step backwards in many, many ways. And I got to say this really quickly. I don't want to dominate it, but,
no,
you know, at the same time, we have these communities of color. Sri represents the Southeast Asian. You know, he is that. He's from India. Community in many ways. And, you know, Rashida Tlaib is Middle Eastern. Now, Middle Eastern folks are classified as white. You know, they've been trying to get that changed. We've had to change the language on the ballots to Arabic to reflect, you know, the difficulty that that some folks have in trying to assimilate, you know, and so that they can fully participate in the election process. And she'll be the first one to tell you that she's not Black and that, yes, representation does matter. But, you know, how do we struggle with that? And I think we lost this opportunity during the redistricting process to have an honest discussion about race. And when I say that to say this, and that is that the discussion was only Black and white, but we have the Middle Eastern community, we have the Asian community, we have these other communities of minority communities who have been rising politically, and there should have been more discussion about how do we make sure that everybody has a fair shot at being represented, but we didn't do that. And so now we have, you know, a situation, and Black folks aren't discriminatory, you know. We got Mike Duggan as mayor. He's a white guy. He's the mayor of Detroit. They voted for him and voted for him three times, you know, because he's doing a good job. So it's really not about that. But what it is about is this idea of fairness. And so I have a granddaughter who's 3 years old and a grandson who's 18 months old and a newborn who is, you know, like 2 months old now. You know, the idea that they can grow up in a world where they don't have a person that looks like them and the Michigan congressional delegation is something that I would have never dreamed of because, you know, I grew up with that and it was inspiring. John Conyers had nominated me to the Naval Academy twice, you know?
Hmm. Well, Greg, they might have to come over to the Republican side because Republicans have 3 African-Americans running for
You know, I said there were limits. I said being Black is a great check. It gives you a star, but at the same time, you know, I mean,
but there is something changing in our politics where race matters just a little bit less and there's a little more acceptance for people who don't look exactly like us. And the one issue I agree with Rashida on is the designation for Arab Americans. My grandfather came from Lebanon. I have an Arab American family. I agree with her on that. I don't agree on anything else, but that one we can be together. And I think we have to find those areas of commonality.
For sure. That's a tough one. And that's a conversation that's long overdue, man. Because the laws that codified race in this country, it was more of a benefit, you know, to be seen, to be accepted as white. At the same time, doing that, and that happened for the Italians, and that happened for the Greeks, and that happened, you know, for the Middle Eastern folks. But it really puts a hardship on people who, I mean, come on, we saw what happened after 9/11. You know, that community was persecuted in lots of ways, you know, out of fear. And the designation just doesn't really match up anymore.
Well, and what we should,
you know, this is the struggle that we're having. This is the struggle that we're having. And John just said it. We got this guy in the 13th, this brother that's going to be running. He graduated from Howard. He graduated from Detroit Public Schools. He lives in Detroit. He worked at the Economic Growth Court. You know, I mean, on paper, it looks like he would be a Democrat, but. You know, I get calls from people telling me, oh, you should talk to this guy because he really just ran as a Republican to get the opportunity because he knew that he couldn't win it on the Democratic side. And I'm like, really? Come on. That's disingenuous, you know, but we'll see. I don't know, John. I mean, you know, it's Emily, it's crazy politics, you know, these days. And certainly, the politics of personality has weighed in heavily here, and the politics of race is still out there. But it's going to be a sad day, and it's going to be a challenge for us as Democrats to live this down and try and move forward. I think that's another thing that could impact, you know, the governor's race here. This idea that everybody's not included when it comes to race on the Democratic side, and people will make noise about that. You can believe it.
Finally, this hour, if you are watching the fight over abortion rights, and it really feels like everyone is these days, Monday was a really intense day in Michigan. As of today, abortion is still legal in Michigan. Emily, can you give us the rundown on what happened this week and just where things stand in the state?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of court maneuvering. But Monday's big action was that the Court of Appeals said that the injunction that was sort of, I think, as Dana Nessel has put it, the thread that was tying or making abortion still legal in Michigan, the Court of Appeals struck down a key part of that, saying that it couldn't tie the hands of essentially all the local county prosecutors. And there are prosecutors in the state who do want to prosecute abortion at this point, or have said that they will review those cases at least. So basically on Monday, it went through this lightning round of court machinations. There was another case that got pulled in, and essentially they put that thread back in place. And that stayed true on a Wednesday hearing as well. My colleague Dave Bechet has been covering all the twists and turns. So we essentially went through a whole whirlwind of machinations and ended up exactly where we were.
Yeah, you tweeted something, Emily, on Monday, you know, that was like we've literally seen decision after decision, and we started right back where we were on Monday.
Absolutely. I think that I think Dave wrote two or three stories in the time that it took to end up right back where we started. So, you know, it's still in place for now, but that situation is very legally tenuous. And I really think that that's going to be a huge issue on the November ballot, no matter what. I mean, even if this injunction is still in place, even if, you know, we're saying that technically our 1931 abortion law that's on the books is not enforceable by local county prosecutors at this point, I think people are very interested in getting that written down and in the Constitution, as opposed to hanging on this sort of single injunction, which of course, you know, those kind of injunctions aren't designed to last forever.
Right.
So I really, you know, I actually talked to some folks at the polls, just, you know, standing outside the polling place, as us political types are wont to do on election day. And of course, it's not on the ballot right now, right? But I talked to a few people who were bringing it up as one of the reasons that they thought voting was really important right now. If that is on the ballot in November, I would anticipate a pretty large Democratic turnout.
Well, let's put this into perspective, right? There was this vote in Kansas, and it is having reverberations across the country. Voters there on Tuesday rejected by a really large margin a ballot measure that would have allowed the GOP-controlled legislature to restrict or just completely ban abortion. This was really the first vote since the U.S. Supreme Court Dobbs decision. Here's President Biden after that vote.
The voters of Kansas sent a powerful signal that this fall, the American people will vote to preserve and protect the right and refuse to let them be ripped away by politicians.
Michigan will, in all likelihood, have its own question on the November ballot enshrining reproductive rights in the state constitution. John, what does the Kansas outcome portend for Michigan?
I think it's an indication of what's going to be sweeping across the country. And bottom line, in an election like this, if we're going in and the conversation is about President Biden, inflation, gas prices, and the economy, Republicans have a significant advantage. If the conversation is about abortion, Democrats have a significant advantage, and they're going to spend a lot of money to make sure that abortion is the issue that everybody's talking about. Now, the one thing that could potentially be a factor, and we saw it many years ago when John McCain and Barack Obama were running for president, when the stock market crashed in October, that race was over. Mm-hmm. So there are issues that could come up. There are things that happen in society that could change the way we look. But as things stand right now, I think this is a big impediment for a Republican victory.
Okay, you three. I could spend an entire another hour talking about the week that was, but we got to wrap it up here. We got to get on with our Fridays. So I want to say a big thanks to you all. Emily Lawler, state government and politics editor at the Detroit Free Press, Greg Bowens, founder of Bowens & Co., and John Truscott, CEO of Truscott Rossman. Thank you so much, you three, for your time today.
It was fun, Zoe. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Okay, on that note, we can find all of these stories and much more at MichiganRadio.org. I am Zoe Clark in today for April Bear. She's back on Monday. This is Stateside.